Hi, this is Ariella Barrere, and you're listening to The Letterboxd Show. I'm here to talk about my four favorites, including Blade Runner and The Conformist, and maybe even How to Blow Up a Fight Flight.
That's right, folks. Our intros are getting fancier, and quote, somehow The Letterboxd Show has returned. Our flagship podcast about movies people love watching is back for a brand new season, and we're kicking things off with a bang. Get it?
Oh, Slim, I've missed you. I've missed this. Letterboxd member and star and co-writer of How to Blow Up a Pipeline, Ariella Barrere, is here, as she said, to talk about her four favorite movies. It is an insane group. Blade Runner, The Conformist, Tie Me Up, Tie Me Down, Love, Exposure. We'll talk about why these four, above all others, made the cut for this show. And we'll get into a little eco-terrorist heist thriller chat. Ariella, welcome to The Letterboxd Show.
Hi, thank you so much for having me.
These faves are big. They're such an eclectic mix of four faves. And right before we recorded, we were talking about how, you know, we watch in advance. But for me personally, three of these were new watches. I hadn't seen three of these movies. So
really?
Big week.
Oh my God. Honestly, huge compliment to me that I introduced you guys, who objectively, I'm sure, know more films than I do.
No way.
Absolutely not. We are not film school nerds. We're here because everything's new to us, I think. It's exciting.
That's right. That's the best thing about, I did not go to film school, and I love that I am forever learning about films.
Film school nerds, if you're listening, we love you just the same as anyone who did not go to film school. We're all on the same team here, Team Movies.
So you found Letterboxd during the pandemic, like many others. But when I look at your alleged Letterboxd account, you've logged exactly two movies, How to Blow Up a Pipeline and The Matrix. I wonder if listeners and Slim can guess which one of those you've reviewed so far.
That's so funny. I guess I did just expose myself for having a secret Letterboxd account for the last 2 years. I didn't realize that doing that when I gave you that information. But yeah, there's a secret Letterboxd
account. Oh, that makes this review so much funnier. This review of How to Blow Up a Pipeline, finally decided to be brave and get on here.
Putting my name on there was brave. I stand by that.
One of my favorite parts about too, like when the Letterboxd Slack, like, finds someone's letterbox, like whether they be a filmmaker, an actor, when you look at like their follow list, there's always like 10 crew members that follow that account. So I wonder if it always just like keys off people like not in the know, like, oh, who's this person that the entire letterbox company is following on Letterboxd?
Oh my God.
Slim, we need our own secret letterbox for when we do that.
Yes.
We can all only follow each other on our secret Letterboxd account.
That's right.
Yeah,
that's
exactly. Right. Yeah. There's another guy on Letterboxd who's reviewed Pipeline a few times now. His name is Daniel. You might know him. And he wrote on September the 1st, 2022, 18 months ago, I read the book How to Blow Up a Pipeline. And today I got to see the movie fully finished. It's everything I hoped it would be and more. Any ideas who that might be?
He has an addiction. To Letterboxd.
And to watching his own movie, it seems.
Yeah. That is famously Daniel Goldhaber, who directed How to Blow Up a Pipeline. He is actually the person who got me on Letterboxd in the pandemic. And we went to Bear Garden. He was checking it at the club.
That's amazing.
he sends us reviews daily, and we have to beg him to stop. Well, I had to stop checking it because it is an addictive thing to do. I mean, it's also like, for me, it was completely narcissistic. I was like, ooh, everyone's talking about me. But they don't always have the nicest things to say.
Right.
Which they have their right to say, you know, that's what the app is for. We're democratizing film criticism, but I don't have to know. Mm-hmm. I don't have to know that people are saying that.
I would imagine too, like, you know, you're doing so much press for the movie. This is probably a fun little break to talk about for your favorite movies, as opposed to, you know, the deep existential questions revolving around the movie. And what better way to start than with Blade Runner 1982, directed by Ridley Scott, written by Hampton Fancher and David Webb Peoples. 4.1 average, and I think we'll get into the music in a little bit too, FYI, about how to blow a pipeline. But let me read the synopsis, just in case anyone has not seen Blade Runner. This might be a Gemma-infused synopsis.
This
I don't know
is
if
the
smog
one that is
choked.
Not. Is
this a smog-choked dystopian is in the actual synopsis?
I'm not that
That seems
poetic.
Like a Gemma line. All right, the synopsis. In the smog-choked dystopian LA of 2019, Blade Runner Rick Deckard is called out of retirement to terminate a quartet of replicants who have escaped to Earth seeking their creator for a way to extend their short lifespans. And Jack, who puts together facts from our community, this is on one of the big lists on Letterboxd, most fans on Letterboxd. This is a beloved film. You're absolutely not alone. And Blade Runner is about to join the Million Watched Club on Letterboxd. So maybe this episode will put it over the edge.
This just in, Slim.
Did it just do it? Oh my God.
I pulled that fact like 7 hours ago and I just went to check and there's a little 1M under Blade Runner.
1 million watches.
And it's just ticked over.
This recording did it officially.
It's in the 1 million watched club. That's it. Ariella, you're responsible.
This is huge.
Congratulations to you and to Ridley Scott together. You'll have to share the award, I think.
Oh, yeah. He can call my people. we'll figure it out.
So do you remember the first time you watched Blade Runner? And then maybe a follow-up question. Do you remember which version you first saw? Because there's several for this movie.
So that's kind of the fun part. I have no idea what versions I've seen. I think I've seen only the latest version. Okay, so brief history. So a lot of my film education came from my mom. She was a writer in Mexico and just was very well versed in film. And I think when she first came to the U.S., she would take a lot of UCLA classes just outside of the school. She didn't actually attend UCLA and she would take a lot of film classes. So a lot of my education, when I told my mom, I think when I was in 7th or 8th grade that I was interested in film, like actually on the level of wanting to make films, not just as an actor. She was like, all right, then you're going to sit down and you're going to learn about films. And she started showing me a bunch, but for some reason she didn't show me Blade Runner. She only endlessly talked about Blade Runner. She was like, and one day you'll watch Blade Runner and it's the best movie ever.
Not to hype it up or anything.
And she would talk about all the different versions she had seen and how, you know, the big existential question at the center of what is it to be human and is he a human or a replicant, and her theories on which version told her what about his place and everything. And I had so many ideas about this movie, and I've always been such a sci-fi fan. I love sci-fi movies. I think it's my favorite genre, if I'm being completely honest. So it had been really built up for me, and then when I was 18 I went on a date to the Egyptian to finally watch it. Wow. And I went with this girl I was seeing and we watched the movie and I loved it and she loved it. And we were also like, this movie's a little weird to women. We also were like, I don't fully know. You know, we were 18 and we were like both very on Tumblr, but also very like, wanting to engage. So we left being like, she said no. But
seriously.
But ultimately, it's my favorite movie. So sometimes you just have to take it for what it was culturally. And I went back home to my mom and was like, that's the best movie I've ever seen in my life. And she was like, right? It changed my taste in movies forever. It changed how I engaged with movies forever. And I just love it so much. And that's the story. And then I recently, hilariously, I hadn't watched it again until last year. So there was a solid there was a solid chunk of time between reviewing when I was 18 versus recently. And it was because I had held to that being my favorite movie and sci-fi being my favorite genre. And then it was playing at IFC in New York. And I went with Daniel Goldhaber, who was like, I like Blade Runner. I don't get like your whole thing about Blade Runner. I was like, no, trust me. We're seeing Blade Runner and it's the best movie ever made. 100% held up. It's an amazing movie. He left being like, you're right. That is one of the best movies ever made. I think he reviewed it on Letterboxd and said like it had reached GOAT status for him. And I was like, yes,
hell yeah.
It's one of the best movies ever made, quite simply. And it is I'm also very interested in political filmmaking, which obviously all sci-fi is political filmmaking. But yeah, just the its central premise of these beings that were created basically to be our slaves and them fighting for their humanity and fighting back. And especially after making Pipeline and like asking the questions of what is violent resistance, what is justified, like these characters embody that argument in a way that is so beautiful. And I mean, the Tears in the Rain speech is everything I've ever wanted to make in a movie. Like, how do you even do that?
I rewatched it this week for the first time, I guess maybe in a few years. And the first time I watched it as an adult, like full on without like watching it on cable or whatever with like 2 hours of commercials, I had forgotten about the scene that you referenced, you know, that kind of like consent scene. And I remember like going on Letterboxd, like, do any of my friends talk about this scene? Like, this is like a really strange scene.
It's
just kind of like in there. I'm like, oh, I wish they would have taken that scene out.
I have notes for his next director's cut.
Yes, exactly. And the direct, and I think you probably saw the final cut, which is the version I think that's popularized now.
Yeah.
And some reviews of my friends on Letterboxd had pointed out, like, there's a version that is, I guess, harder to track down, but there's like a Harrison Ford, like, you know, narrated version, which makes it like a little less nebulous in certain versions about whether or not he is or isn't a replicant. Like, it's almost like more inferred that you could read into certain things. Like, he's having weird dreams. Like, that horse scene is like one of the famous ones that, like, that's a dream that he keeps having. And then the guy, his part, like, not the partner, but Edward James Olmos does the, what do you call that? Where you're folding the origami. He leaves like an origami of the horse to kind of like make you think like, oh, did they implant the horse dreams in Harrison? But that stuff is like more vague now. They got rid of all that stuff. So I like it more vague. I like these the final cut the best for me.
Yeah. It's interesting though, because I was so influenced by my mom before watching it. My mom always, I think she mentioned this narrated version and you know, was convinced he's a replicant and would always pitch it, he's a replicant. So I went in on my first viewing so looking for the answers that I left wanting a little more versus watching it again years later. I got to actually kind of see it for what it is. I feel like that's always the tough thing about watching a movie that has been so
hyped up
for you. And this is also just something I've been learning about myself and film criticism after having made a movie, is like how much I have in the past and how much people often review movies based on just what they wanted the movie to be versus what the movie is. And so that was the kind of the part that I struggled with the most on my first viewing was wanting it to be this thing that my mom had explained to me versus the second time I watched it.
There's a review on Letterboxd by, I'm going to try and pronounce this, Jaxriel.
How funny would it be if that was my secret Letterboxd account you're about to read? No.
here we go. Is it possible? There is a review on Letterboxd from Ariella's secret Letterboxd account, which writes, is it possible for humans and robots to ever experience true love? And I find that really interesting, and I'm going to go out on a limb, and I'm sure that there are many, many reckons around this. And the consent scene is, it's okay to love Blade Runner and hate that scene. But I also wonder, because we love Harrison Ford, and because Harrison comes to Blade Runner with all of the things that we love about the actor, are we being clouded by my personal thirst for Harrison Ford into forgetting that he may not be capable of making human empathetic decisions around consent? And is that central to the ultimate question? Is it possible for robots to become human? Is it possible for humans and robots to ever experience true love?
That's fascinating. I had never really asked that question. That's such a good angle. And that's such a good perspective to like kind of recontextualize that scene as sort of the comment there. The music is a little misleading because it plays like a romantic scene.
There is that.
Yeah. But I do love that question. But I also think it's so interesting when you think about how, you know, the replicants interact with each other. I recently dressed up as, I can't think of her name. How embarrassing after.
Daryl Hannah.
Daryl Hannah. Her character, the care that they actually show for each other while manipulating the humans around them is fascinating. It's arguably like the most romantic relationship in the movie is between the like proud replicants.
Yeah, I look at this and I sort of relate it to Ex Machina, and I remember the discourse around the ending of Ex Machina was like, "Yeah, you go, girl," because the robot has the female human form, and I was like, "Yeah, you go, robot, who has been cast in human female form." Mm. This is not necessarily a feminist film or a feminist decision that's been made. It's a robot who doesn't want to be deprogrammed, getting the fuck out of there.
Oh my God. Now I have to rewatch Blade Runner.
This system works. The Letterboxd show is doing its job.
Also, I just want to say, I looked ahead to Slim's notes and it's just like, Harrison's watch, Rutger's white socks. Slim, come through with your costuming.
I focus on like different things, whatever version, like whatever time I watch a movie. So like Harrison Ford's watch, I got super into watches since I first saw this movie. He's got an amazing watch in this movie, digital watch. You can look it up on eBay. It's like $500.
Yeah. Oh, wow.
But Rutger Hauer, you know, that famous scene where he's like beating Harrison Ford up for like 20 minutes.
Okay.
He's wearing like bicycle shorts and like black running shoes, but with almost like knee-high white socks that are just kind of like trickled down to his ankles. It's like, it's such an 80s look in a movie that's like almost timeless in most ways. I just thought that was funny.
I love the fashion of that movie. And I love that scene so much. I love the way that at every turn he injures himself to even the playing field and then continues. Kick his ass. Like, it's amazing. And just walking through that sort of logic that the replicants have, or that he has, where he is like, I will do this fairly. I will stab myself so that you have even ground. But it it's such a good scene.
It's also crazy. One thing I thought about too, you know, Harrison Ford has like short hair in this, which is like something I always forget about, like shorter than you're used to in your head. But man, he had so many bangers. Like, what are the, like, is there another actor that just had so many franchise hits like around this time frame in the 80s, late 70s, late 80s? It's crazy how many like big budget hits, and not just big budget hits, but like timeless hits.
Yeah,
because like, we're getting another Indiana Jones next month. I mean,
thank God. Thank God. Yeah. Finally, by the way, it's time.
I'm so excited.
Me too.
I just want to ask before we move on to the next film, how are we all feeling about AI? Just a small question.
We're going to be working for AI in probably 5 years' time.
Oh, man.
We'll need universal income.
My friends and I have like had little jokes about AIs, about like what language we use around it now is going to be offensive when we're adults. And like, what are we going to not be able to let go of? Like, you know how we talk about like our grandparents grew up in a different time. Like that's how our kids will talk about us when they bring home their first like robot boyfriend.
And oh man.
Like, you're being a bigot. And I'll be like, that's a washing machine. Like
washing machine is going to be outlawed probably as hate speech. You'll be in jail if you say that.
Yeah,
it is.
My 7-year-old said to me the other day, hey mom, what if there was no internet? And I was like, oh my God, here we go. I'm going to have to tell him about how there was a time where there was no internet. And that I have lived that time. Speaking of living that time, I feel like when I watched The Conformist, Bernardo Bertolucci's 1970 film, that I was watching, you know, a film that was made this year. And I think this is a film you could watch in any given year and think, wow, this is a film about these times. It is an extraordinary film about a weak-willed Italian man who becomes a fascist flunky who goes abroad to arrange the assassination of his old teacher, who is now a political dissident, using his own honeymoon as a cover. Or, as Letterboxd member Erin Harrington writes, the perks of being a fascist wallflower. So this film premiered at the 20th Berlin International Film Festival in 1970, and it went off in Italy. It was made on $750,000 budget. It took over $200 million at the Italian box office alone. Right? That is insane.
Wow,
geez. Oh, I didn't know that. Yeah.
And one more fun fact I learned from Letterboxd reviews as I was researching this. The Conformist has a direct dialogue with Plato's Allegory of the Cave. Mm-hmm. Ariella's across this. And yes, the philosophy nerds on Letterboxd do have plenty of lists based around this allegory. Films on them include our friend Blade Runner, The Truman Show, Apocalypse Now, The Matrix, Slim's fave, Vanilla Sky.
Hell yeah.
The Lego Movie, and Sausage Party. Makes sense. It makes sense.
That's
it makes
perfect
sense.
Perfect list. They could never have come up with a better list of things, of movies to share that's in common. That's perfect.
All right. So talk us through. Is it because of Plato's Allegory of the Cave, or is it because Jean-Louis Trintignant is completely hot, or is it because of the new bride getting together with the dissident's hot wife? What is it about The Conformist?
Okay, so this is another one. It's funny that these were paired together because they are, I guess my backstory for a lot of these is actually going to be really similar. But as well as my mother, another person whose film education has been totally vital for me is my sister, who's a genius. And this was her favorite movie. And this is a new movie for me. But we just, so she took a class also at UCLA, but she graduated from UCLA. She took an Italian cinema class there where she watched this movie for the first time. She was like 18 and has loved it ever since. And so we went recently to go see it in New York. It was playing, and I got to get a little like film education from her on it as we saw it. And just like the way she was able to talk about the Plato's cave allegory and the way it kind of resurfaces and all the images of the movie and plays with like the way you're receiving information and truth and fiction and manipulation through this visual metaphor is brilliant. And it's a fun little history lesson too. We walked home after the movie where she just explained to me every point she could remember from her class. And I haven't stopped thinking about the movie since then. So I know originally I had a different movie in my top four. And before we did this, I was like, change it. I love this movie now. I want to talk about this. This is the goal for political making for me.
Wow.
And yeah, I will see the Battle of Algiers one day, but thank you for changing it. Cause this was, I mean, story aside, fascist, anti-fascist themes aside, it was one of the most beautiful things I think I've ever seen in my life. And even though it's not in the Letterboxd top 50 now, it has been, and it has influenced probably 125 out of those 250 films in direct and indirect ways. Slim, what did you think of The Conformist?
I have to say, so there was a recent 4K restoration. Kino Lorber, I think, has the 4K restoration of this. It looks insane. This movie is one of the most beautiful things I've ever seen. I mean, there's a few scenes in their apartment with like the lights coming through the blinds, which my pea brain can't comprehend the planning that went into that shot and like the work that involved to make all of those shots look so gorgeous. I mean, even when he's talking with his mentor in his office and the way that the shadow,
the cave yes. for the first time. Yeah.
Oh my God. And then his shadow disappears when he closes like the blinds. I thought the whole thing was wild. We talked about like movies I had. So this is one of those movies I hadn't seen before. This is one of the reasons why I love this podcast, because it kind of like almost forces me to experience something I probably would have never added to my watch list. Like, Italian movie from the 70s. Like, but it's just like, I know I'm not alone in thinking that. And I try to like be the every man for other people listening to this podcast. But with that said, I thought it was phenomenal. I mean, all from beginning to end, like literally the last scene of the movie is bonkers. But just like mind blowing, I thought.
I was going to say something so dumb, just that my sister, for some reason, had told me it was a short movie and I chugged so much water before. So the stakes of that last scene were so high for me.
There's a few things I thought during watching The Conformist for the very first time. Vittorio Storaro is allowed to do Dutch angles. I'm known for my dislike of Dutch angles in certain types of films, but they're 100% allowed in this for very, very obvious reasons. I I was really interested in how there are no small rooms in this movie. There are just no small rooms except the professor's office, which I found really interesting. Like even the hotel rooms, and you know, if anyone's been to Paris, you know that you can only fit your suitcase or yourself in an elevator in a hotel. And the rooms are tiny and the toilet's basically next to the bed. But even the hotel rooms were huge. But then this beautiful conversation, like you say, when he closes the blinds and the shadow disappears and it's just them in the office, it feels like it's the closed heart of the entire film. When the beggars start just singing the Internationale at him, I was like, we got to bring that tradition back. We should just follow and sing at every fascist we ever meet on the streets. Like if we all just start doing that, maybe things will change. And then I wondered how, if at all, but you've only just seen it recently, so maybe not, the conformist helped inform the structure of Pipeline, because both films kind of drop us into things, but then do this kind of double, triple looping flashback to build memory and perception across,
Walking out of that movie, I was like, damn, wish I'd seen this before Pipeline. I was like, this really would have been a good one to have on the list there. It all worked out how it was supposed to work out. It's all fine. But I'm very happy with how explicitly political Pipeline is and how, you know, straightforward its messaging is. I'm also very, very interested in films like The Conformist that do take that muddier human approach to issues around this and even something as severe as fascism. getting in the weeds of the relationships of the people is something I'm very interested in exploring in film in the future.
But I think we can't move on from the conformist. I'm calling the fascist. That's hilarious. We definitely can't move on without asking about the dancing scene and how that dropped with you.
So well done, and it feels like a. See, I don't know. My 70s Italian cinema education is not huge. But that scene felt so ambitious to just capture everything as clearly as it did, all of the relationship dynamics and like between these huge, huge set pieces and all of those background actors and everyone moving in one, yet it's completely coherent. You can track everything and it just... Mm-hmm. I was really impressed. I was like, I don't see that done well in films today often. It's such a hard thing to accomplish, and it's mastered in that scene. Mm.
My buddy left a review, Proto, on The Conformist that a couple years ago, so as I watched it, I went back to his review, and it started to make a little bit more sense. He said, strange to get Wes Anderson vibes emanating from the past, but I could feel it. Some of the framing and locations were out of sight. Was this filmed on Earth? Our Earth? Take me to Italy, Bertolucci. The scene at the hospital and anytime someone is walking, roll that out as a wallpaper in the boudoir. So yeah, every frame of this movie was nuts, for sure.
Amazing. Wow. That's so real.
It's so real. In these times, it's so fascinating to watch a film that is all about a man refusing to have fun. Like just refusing all temptation. He's got this hot wife. He's got the professor's hot wife, but there's a lot going on for him. Mm-hmm. His life could have gone a number of different ways, but he chose absolutely normal, nothing to see here. And it's just fascinating to see that laid out at a time now where it feels like if we don't stand on principle for something, then what the F are we all doing here?
Yep. I just want to leave it at that. That's so beautiful. I have nothing better to add to that.
Well, let's get into how to blow up a pipeline, because I wanted to bring it up earlier when we were talking about Blade Runner, because one of the standouts, you know, when I watched the movie was the score. And when I was watching Blade Runner after the fact in Tangerine Dream, I was like, damn, I'm getting big time parallel vibes between both movies. So maybe tell us a little bit about how that came together for How to Blow Up a Pipeline, because I'm guessing many movies were inspirations in many ways for the film itself.
Yeah. Blade Runner was a huge, generally just a huge inspiration, but mostly for the score. That was Gavin Brivik, our composer, is brilliant and lovely. And he came out to the desert to record actual sounds of the locations we were in and of the sort of infrastructure that we were shooting around. He would just kind of mess with it and get whatever sounds he could out of it so he could then sample it and put in the score. So it already had this kind of like machine feel to it. And I feel like the Blade Runner is just kind of like the all-timer best synth score ever. I don't know. Maybe there's a better one, but I'm obsessed. I listen to it just in my free time. So that was a huge inspiration. I actually forgot this story until recently when someone asked why we shot in Long Beach, but I also love the Annihilation score a lot.
Oh, hell yeah.
Now you're talking Slim's language.
I mean, even just like the sound, like when the scene, you know, in the cave where it officially hits, that score hits.
It feels so unnatural and inhuman, and it's crazy. Danny and I went location scouting ourselves in Long Beach to get I've spent a lot of time in Long Beach, but he had never been. And I was like, I promise you, there is some crazy infrastructure there. It's hidden from the big city. Like, it is actually laid out, so it's hidden. But there's like a bridge where you can see everything. And then like, there are all the little houses around the refineries. So we drove over this bridge where you get a clear view of two refineries as well as all the ports. And we were listening to the Annihilation soundtrack as we did it. God. And the just horror of that experience. He was like, I'm sold. It takes place in Long Beach. We're shooting here.
Wow. That's so cool.
So that was also part of it.
Awesome. I want to read you two Letterboxd reviews. Jeez. I'm sure you've seen them. I'm sure you've read them.
Yours.
Carsten writes, it just lights a fire under your ass by the end, the way Lahane and Do the Right Thing do. But for how much influence it wears on its sleeve, the film stands alone as its own angsty take on the contemporary heist film that rightfully captures its urgency.
I loved that.
And then Maddie, 1.5 stars. Basically, if that clip of Greta Thunberg saying blah, blah, blah was a feature film.
Maddie, please.
Why?
Maddie, oh my God. So... Oh man, I can bring it back with a review from Nick who talks about, you know, the sound design, obviously, the tone, the 16mm visuals. What really helps though is the writing and the surprisingly elegant structure of the story. So let's talk about that surprisingly elegant story structure. Like, what does writing look like for you and Daniel, especially since you took a nonfiction activist manifesto where Andreas' mom is suggesting that it's time to drop the commitment to moral pacifism and fight fire with fire.
It was fun. It was like, I mean, I wrote it with Daniel Goldhaber and Jordan Scholl, who we were all just buds before this. So writing a movie like this with your good friends is just a great time. But a lot of the start of the writing of the project was both the core idea was, what if it was us and our friends who went out and did this tomorrow? And then Danny really wanted to push to make a piece of propaganda. But I was a little nervous about that because while I had been engaging with ideas of property destruction as legitimate protest, and that's something I deeply, deeply believe in, I think making a piece of propaganda can almost hurt a movement like that. I mean, someone probably can do it well, but I think with this title and with how just sort of provocative it is, putting those ideas out there without the context of that larger discussion and without the human part of it all, where like we are all forced to participate in the system to varying degrees, and shutting it down will have immediate repercussions on people. I mean, the harm it would inflict on people probably not as severe. I mean, objectively not as severe as the harm of climate change, but something to be considered. And so these initial conversations were kind of the immediate narrative hook of the movie. It was the hook of the characters and their conflict. But we ultimately wanted it to be an aspirational movie where the group can ultimately come together under the shared idea of and belief of what they're doing, even if they disagree with the minutiae of it. And that was ultimately also what a lot of the original conversations between Danny and I were, where we agree with this larger cause, even if our details are different. And then we also got to Andreas immediately, once he was kind of on board, introduced us to so many activists that we could talk to about their experience. And we were just asking our friends like what their relationship to this was. And we found that all of these stories that we have in the movie kind of already existed, like no more than 2 degrees of separation away from us already. So the realistic answer to what would this look like if us and our friends did this was this group. We were also advised by an activist that these people shouldn't know each other too well for the sake of like protecting identities and if one person goes down, it's not necessarily traceable to other people. Mm-hmm. So that's also part of why they have such different backgrounds. But I think also, you know, living somewhere like LA, you get people from a bunch of different backgrounds that have come together in one place.
I wrote in my Letterboxd review after watching it that I compared it to Heat, but for environmental activists.
Yes.
And that was like I haven't seen that too much in reviews. You know, there's a lot of bigger inspirations and comparisons that happen, but yeah, Heat was the first movie I thought of. And I think it does speak to like the urgency in Heat, because there's so many scenes in that movie where you're kind of also like crapping your pants a little bit, like while you're watching these scenes happen. Like that scene with De Niro, you know, he hears that noise in the background and it's just like that Heat vision on him, and he decides to like pull the plug on the gig. And I mean that as like,
I just watched this movie for the time, by the way.
Really? How was it?
Great. I love it. It's funny that you bring it up though.
Great. I loved it. 5 stars.
Our big inspiration was Thief, hilariously.
Yes.
Other movies, nice. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Thief is so good.
Ooh, I just wanted to mention like, this is new to me, but it was a fresh watch.
Hell yeah. But it's an amazing movie.
You picked up on something I loved, Slim, was, you know, the moments where people are just doing things. They're just doing the things that need to be done. And then Forrest Goodluck does the thing in the shed. Oh my God. And then the crash zooms onto the pressure meter thingies on the pipeline, whatever they're called. It was just like, there was some fun there. You could have thrown in a Dutch angle and I would have been happy. It was great.
This is something that Danny and I recently talked about. That we kind of were doing, mostly him and Tequila were doing, but we hadn't quite explicitly discussed it the way we recently did, where we were really trying to use, like, we explicitly talk about wanting to use genre conventions, but like also just very conventional filmmaking practices to make it kind of feel poppy and commercial so that we can kind of make these ideas something that like would be a fun commercial movie for someone who is not immediately interested in the idea of it. They're like, well, at least there's a fun heist movie to watch. Mm-hmm. Or like, you know, nothing about like the visual language is too alienating or severe or extreme and artsy, because, you know, the ideas itself can already be so alienating that keeping this language consistent, I think is like a really fun subversion of like conventional filmmaking techniques. I mean, obviously there is some like there's a lot of artistry that went into it as well. Like Tequila did an incredible job shooting in. It's shot on 16mm, which is amazing. And it's beautiful. And
do
I
you mean like using the tools of the oppressor to dismantle the tools of the oppressor?
I do personally believe pop filmmaking to be the oppressor.
No.
The long game from Ariella kicking off right now.
There's your headline. Oh God. I've really been learning my lesson on sound bites and headlines with this press circuit. Oh boy. I've learned the hard way. You make one little offhanded joke and you've got a headline.
Oh man. Yeah. And then you need a really good publicist to write and go, they didn't really mean that. Can we make sure that that's not the, you know, main part of the story?
It's always been so low stakes. I've worked mostly in like fun TV stuff, you know, all you can really say is like, my character was up to this and this and this day. And this is ripe for paraphrasing this translating.
But were you also like, I was thinking about how there just aren't enough good, like really good radical activist films. Like there was a film that came out a few years ago where Robert Redford was an old weather underground guy and that some journalist unearthed him and he had to go on the run. But because he was old, he was sort of like, not really be able to run very fast and kind of falling over fences. And it was very, it was very sort of pedestrian. But then Woman at War came along, that great Icelandic film about the woman on the bicycle who blows up pipelines. Well, she blows up power lines and she just like cycles to her action and then cycles back to Reykjavik. It's so cool. Anyway, I just think we need more films like yours and Woman at War. And
I totally agree. And it's interesting. Like people ask if we consider ourselves like activists or if this is an activist act. And I say firmly, no. I think like cultural production is an absolutely vital part of a movement, but we're quite simply in making this movie not activists. Like I do find it interesting the argument of like using the master's tools to like that whole, you know, what you just referenced, and I find it interesting because it's like, but this itself is not the radical act that we're portraying. Like quite simply, that's not what we're doing. We made a film to push a conversation and ask a question to reach more people, so that ideally they can then engage in real life with these activist groups. And even myself, I'm finding myself getting more involved in action, not like actions, but in groups and organizations right now, because like that's the real work. This is just cultural production, which again, valuable, necessary, but not activism.
That's exactly what a propagandist would say. Subversive propagandist would tell us to explain things. Come on to you. I will say Woman at War, which you mentioned, I just added that to my watch list. It's on HBO Max right now. So if anyone else wants to give it a shot alongside of me, let's do it.
It's so good. It's so good. How did you spend the pandemic? Did you spend it tied up to a bed with Antonio Banderas bringing you painkillers? Or
I did watch that movie for the first time in the pandemic, hilariously. But here's where it gets weird. This is another one that my mom loved and introduced me to.
Oh my God.
We need to get your mom's letterbox. We should get a letterbox.
Honestly, she just walked from the door. She's a huge Pedro Almodovar fan. And she's the one who really was like, you have to educate yourself on Pedro Almodovar. And like, her favorite was Time Up, Time Down. And I finally, I don't know why, I think my mom had like an education planned for me. So she started with introducing me to like, the easy ones. She was like, I think the first one she showed me was like Pulp Fiction. Mm. And then she was like, and The Sixth Sense, and like these kind of poppy but great films. And she took me to like Synespia for the first time when I was 13, and we watched Chinatown. Wow. And she is just brilliant. And so, but she never, I think she also never wanted to sit with me and watch Time Me Up, Time Me Down. She was just kind of, you have to watch that when you want to watch that.
By the end of the show, we need her secret letterbox as well.
Yeah.
Her secret letterbox.
I know. I want to get my mom on letterbox.
She's in the house, right? She should just come and sit with you and tell us why. Tell us why Time Me Up, Time Me Down was on her list of things she wanted her child.
My mom was a big believer also of not sheltering me from ideas. You know, she's like, you as a child can watch whatever you want, and like, we'll just talk about it, and we'll go through the idea. I remember she would take me to R-rated movies when I was like six, because she was like, what about this isn't life that you have to learn? So she was, I forget what age I was, but I was young, and she took me to see Once, and like, I loved that movie. I was obsessed with that movie as like an 8-year-old. But it was rated R. And she was like, what, curse words? Who cares? So, like, what's the worst these people do? Have sex? Like, grow up.
I feel a whole lot better about accidentally walking my 7-year-old into John Wick 4 the other day instead of the Super Mario Brothers movie.
That's what, she was a little bit more careful around, like, violence. She was like, I don't know if you need to. Well, I think also she took me to see Iron Man when that came out. And I got really scared. I don't know why. That one scared me. Like, The Sixth Sense I sat through, but Iron Man, really scary movie to me.
Yeah, that'll do a number on people.
It could be. I've always had an aversion to tech billionaire narcissists.
We can never escape them.
Let's talk about this. So for those who haven't seen this one, it's Tie Me Up, Tie Me Down, 1989. It's not one of Almodovar's highest rated films on Letterboxd. In fact, it's one of his lower rated films by far, but it's got a perfect 3.5 average. So, you know, works for me. Ricky, Antonio is Ricky. He's recently released from a psychiatric institution for good behavior or just like good sex with the institution nurses. And he goes to a film set to see Marina, a woman he had sex with a few years earlier randomly. And after she wraps shooting on the new film, while the crew parties and her sister Lola wonders where she is, Ricky has Marina tied up, hostage, in her apartment in the hopes that she will fall in love with him, marry him, have his babies. This famously got an NC-17 rating from the MPAA. But it is also the film that launched Antonio into America and ultimately brought us Puss in Boots. So I can't be mad about it at all. It's just a couple more Letterboxd facts. It sits on a bunch of lists ranging from horniest movies, horror movies by gay directors, black comedy, high camp, and love melancholy. So which is it? A horror film? A black comedy? A camp cinema? A love story?
High camp. I think it's brilliant. High camp. Oh, I just want to quickly recognize my own hypocrisy where I'm like, Blade Runner has that one weird scene. And then I'm like, I love Tie Me Up, Tie Me Down. Human beings not perfect.
There's someone in our Twitter mentions after posting this show, pushing their glasses up. Excuse me, she's pointing out Blade Runner, but if you recall.
I said it first. No, it's an insane movie. And I have to admit, I haven't seen it in 2 years now. A lot of it just holds sentimental value because I think I watched it. I was like, my mom's the coolest person ever.
So I looked into this because I had the same thing. I was like, why? Yes. Okay. This is as recreation writes on Letterboxd. Well, I don't like rom-coms about kidnapping and sexual assault, but I do like Primary Colors. Boy, this one's a real pickle.
I think that's my exact feeling. I think that summed up. But because I have to be honest with you, I couldn't even tell you half the plot. I couldn't tell you like half of what happens in that movie. But boy, did I have a fun time. I think I watched it. You know what I do remember very distinctly about watching it? We watched this before we wrote Pipeline. This was so Danny Jordan and I had this like month long potted, like we were all basically living together. Like I had my own apartment. Jordan was staying with Danny in LA. But I was basically just crashing every night and we were watching movies all night. And I think this fell in that time where we were just doing that. And we kept talking about the actual suspense that we felt during the movie. Like that, the high wire act of it, I think is like what Danny said or something. But there was something to how off the wall and thrilling it was. That stuck with me. And what a fun time it was to watch it with my friends.
Yeah, this is my second Almodovar. First one was The Skin I Live In. What a first one to watch. So then I come with this one. And then Antonio, the first time Antonio appears on the screen, he's so young. This is maybe the earliest Antonio film I'd ever seen. But when we're talking about like the camp aspect, the dark comedy, the drama, I don't think I've ever seen a movie deal with like these themes in an attempt at camp before. So I almost like didn't even know how to react because it's
super inappropriate.
It is. And like the Stockholm syndrome aspect of it, like, is she in love with him? Or like, because it, you know, you have to watch the movie and spoiler on a 30-year-old movie or whatever, but like there is a point in the movie where that switch is flipped a little bit. And I remember like pulling down my glasses, like, what? Like, is she? Like, I still even couldn't remember, like, couldn't believe like how that twist happened because the entire plot was new to me. And then you get to the ending with her sister and him in the car, and she has that moment.
And we believe it, right? Mm-hmm. We believe it.
Yeah, you do. You do believe it as the viewer. And I love that because it almost makes me like question myself, like in that moment, like, wait, am I believing this? Should I believe this? What should I feel right now? And that's the kind of emotion that I love getting from a movie.
Yeah.
Do you believe it, Gemma? Do you believe it?
I think I believe one of the keys to this is that it was made in Catholic Spain in 1989 when heterosexual marriage was still at the top of its game. And this is a gay man observing society and culture and going, marriage is Stockholm syndrome. Marriage is a trap. Marriage is enslavement. We promise all these things to each other. And then on balance, the statistics just don't add up in terms of who marriage is good for, even to this day. And I'm just going to, you know, play around with that. And there's also, you know, the clue to the whole thing is in a conversation between Marina's sister Lola and the director of the film within the film, where she's like, what are we making here, a love story or a horror story? And he's like, they're indistinguishable. And that's kind of marriage as well in many ways. Hey, I love my husband. He doesn't listen to this. It's fine. But, you know, I think that that's where the kind of nub of it all is. And that when you elevate that into high camp, it's kind of why I'm not mad about it. Like, I was sort of getting grumpy about the fact that I like this so much, but it works because Almodovar loves his characters. And for, you know, she's a recovering junkie. He's a man on the verge of a nervous breakdown, and Almodovar does not judge them. Also, it's very telling that the NC-17 from The Americans was more for the scuba diving masturbation scene in the bath than any of the horny sex or rope-based violence. Women are just not allowed their own pleasure.
No, I love what you say, though, but I think that's kind of the key to my love of this movie is this is a gay man doing camp about heterosexual marriage. And it's inappropriate in its subject matter and its humor, but that's kind of what makes it so perfectly perverted and hilarious. And I don't know, there's something about it, that feeling of it and the characters and their kind of absurdity, and also the beauty of it visually and just story-wise, is what ultimately sticks with me when I think about the movie. That and my mom.
Gorgeous color. I mean, the visuals popped in this movie too. I mean, we talked about it in your previous three movies, but there's just something about Almodovar's movies. Mm. You know, they're like eye candy in so many respects.
Oh my God.
Really? Yeah, it's like eating a cake.
Mm-hmm. Yep.
It works because they're hot. If Antonio was not hot, if he was not at the peak of his hotness, I think that we would have...
I've got a hot take. I think this movie plays up the ugly in Antonio Banderas in a way that makes him hotter than ever before. He's disgusting in half of this movie.
So true.
He's like, I didn't know Antonio Banderas could look like that. I didn't, like, the sweat and the sort of, like, he has, like, this kind of, like, unibrow going a little bit, or maybe I'm inventing that, but, like, I remember him being, like, really gross. But you know that theory that, like, you have to be a little hot, a little ugly to be, like, truly hot? That's seeing him.
I don't know
there,
that I theory. Just, like, I it. Love that theory.
I feel like that theory is empowering me right now. I feel like I need to put that in my diary. Like, I need to remind myself of that every day.
I think about it every day I get dressed. And, like, every time I'm doing my makeup or whatever, I think it's made me a hotter person to embrace the ugly. And I think that is Antonio Banderas is ugly in this movie. And that's why it's his hottest movie.
Words to live by.
I mean, it is so funny, though, because so many of the reviews are basically like, Eden writes, when the dick is so good, you forget you've been kidnapped. Cinema Void, you might say it's problematic, but let's face it, it's easy to forget you've been kidnapped when your captor is Antonio Banderas at the peak of his dick game. Like, there's a lot of that. But I was thinking, okay, this is 1989, but so many of the Tar reviews were also like, I would be groomed by Lydia Tar. I would 100%.
Right. Yeah, that's right.
Like, we have this, I guess movies are, my hot take, I guess movies allow us to have this other side of ourselves separate from Twitter discourse where we go, huh, what if? And then that plays out and we go, okay, cool. I didn't have to live it, but I got to see it and I got to have some confused feelings within myself about it. And now I can move on.
One of my favorite like definitions of satire that I've heard was told to me by Issa Matsai, who is Daniel's writing partner. And I was writing something and she was giving me notes and she was like, true satire is not about making fun of others, but like finding yourself in this and looking inwards. And I do think that is a lot of what Tie Me Up, Tie Me Down does so well. You leave that wondering, why do people stay and why was I involved? Why was I invested in this? Why do I find this hot? Which I think is a question we need to be asking ourselves, or movies need to be posing more. Like, why do we find this hot? But because it's hot.
Well,
you know what I mean? Like, we call her movies that make you question mm-hmm. yourself. Yeah.
I think
what
that 100% brings us to the final film, which is 4 hours long and we have no time to talk about. And that is Sion Sono's Love Exposure from 2008, about a young man who has been kung fu trained in the ancient art of upskirt photography, trying every which way to earn his religious father's forgiveness and confusing the woman of his dreams into thinking she's a lesbian through a little spot of cross-dressing. We are talking about Love Exposure. We got 4 minutes to cover 4 hours.
Context for this. So this was also during the period where Danny, Jordan, and I were hanging out every day. And Danny decided for his birthday, his one gift he asked from us was that we sit and watch Love Exposure in full. We did the 4 hour movie and we agreed because it was his birthday and that was his ask. And I fell in love with this movie as we were watching it. To be clear, it's not like cool to gay people. No. It's not like the most progressive movie I've ever seen. But as a queer person, also, I just so appreciate how off the wall it is. I think there is something. My sensibilities have really changed in the last few years, and there is something to these movies that dare to question and don't come to the right conclusion all the time and can be really messed up and offensive. And also, it's totally legitimate to take your own thing away from that. And I know I left being totally captivated by this like religious epic that it posed. I think like all of the religious imagery, all of the cult stuff, all of the ways that these people are looking for community and higher powers together. It's just something that I think about all the time. And like my goal after watching that movie was like, I want to make my Love Exposure epic that's like for gay people.
Can you please make that? And can you please not be outed as a sex pest years later? That would be very nice.
You know what? I've found that it's like not that hard to not be a sex pest my whole life.
People listening.
See,
take
Sono,
notes,
if you're listening.
Yeah.
I mean, I found out that Love Exposure is based a lot on his childhood where he, at the age of 17, ran away from home and joined a cult. So this is also the guy who dropped out of film school because he was watching porn. And I'm guessing he didn't get a lot of good guidance early on in his life. And that's led to some of the allegations that have come out recently from many of the actresses he's worked with.
I'll be honest, I didn't know about the allegations when I picked this stuff. So I'm not really standing by that one. I actually didn't know that, which is interesting. I really did go down the Sion Sono deep dive after watching this movie, and I saw his other one at Sundance.
The one with Nick Cage in it.
Yeah.
I don't think they came out until after the Nicolas Cage movie. Yeah. So in lockdown, nothing would have been out during, you know, the start of the pandemic. And I do have to say, like, man, it sounds so great to live with like your friends and just fire up movies. Like if someone picks a movie and you all have to watch it, that sounds amazing.
Also, it's a genius. It's a genius birthday present to oneself to bully your friends into watching your favorite film. And that's exactly what I'm doing next month for a very significant birthday. I've hired a cinema. I'm making all my friends watch my favorite movie. They don't know what it is. They think it's one of potentially four. And I'm like, I'm all for introducing that as a form of birthday bullying for film lovers everywhere.
You know what? I want to quickly say We don't have time to talk about it, but because I've just learned that Sion Sono is a sex pest, my new number four, Strange Days, Catherine Bigelow.
Ooh. Oh, what a picture.
There it
what
is.
What a friggin' picture. Jeez.
I was debating. I couldn't decide whether I was already on the fence about a couple of these because a lot of them just hold more sentimental value, obviously, as the history. But Strange Days is like, I can talk about it. That'll be for next time.
Oh, that's going straight to my watch list. But Slim, have you seen it?
Oh,
it's so
I have seen it. That one, I think it might have floated around on HBO Max recently, but for the longest time, it was like hard to watch. Like unless you had the DVD from your library or whatever, it's not like streaming.
I saw it at the Metrograph.
Oh.
And it was so good to see it with an audience.
Oh my God. Yeah, it's like one of those movies you watch, at least in my opinion, like, why aren't more people talking about Strange Days? Like Strange Days used to be on like every streaming platform because I mean, the last act of that movie is nuts. And I think when I had first watched it, you know, there unfortunately was another event in America that was the top news item. And then you watch Strange Days and you're like, holy crap, when was this made? And like, this is now more relevant than ever almost when it was made before. So
it's interesting because it's a movie about police violence and police corruption made in the 90s, post Rodney King. And I don't think, I mean, obviously it plays into a degree of tropey stuff that you had to do at the time. Like there is the one good cop that saves the day. And that's not my favorite part of the movie. But generally, the whole conspiracy anti-cop thing, I don't even think you could put in a movie right now, like a big budget studio movie that she was able to do. I don't think you could fully have that happen right now. And she did it in the 90s.
Yeah.
And I think that's amazing. I mean, if I were to do it today, I would take out that little ending part, but like the rest of it, incredible.
I'm just looking at the cast. I'm sorry. Ralph Fiennes, Angela Bassett, Juliet Lewis,
And Angela Bassett, incredible in that movie. Ralph Fiennes also.
Yeah.
Slim, what's your pitch for why it needs to go on my watch list?
Ralph Fiennes' hair in that movie, but also that there's another character that has crazy hair. Tom Sizemore, which is one of my favorite, because like when my friends watched Strange Days for the first time, they're like, what's up with Tom Sizemore's hair in this movie? I was just looking, so I think this was this her follow-up to Point Break? I was trying to figure out like how this movie exists and like how it existed like at the time, because we're saying like you can't even make it now, but like how did she make it then in 1995? And I guess maybe Point Break maybe cashed the check for that movie.
And it was written by James Cameron. Which Jim. Helped.
Jim.
Yeah. Yeah.
I do want to say one more thing about the allegations of a director. I think like these conversations are still valuable because, you know, we as movie watchers connect in so many different ways with movies, and then something comes out and it's horrific. But then like you have to grapple with like, you know, I love this movie so much, and in my aspect of other movies, like so much of my personality is like, I love this movie. What does that mean for me now that like, will people judge me? Like I obviously do not support that, but like, it just raises up so many different questions as like a movie watcher and a member of a film loving community that there's no real easy answers, and everyone has to kind of confront these things in their own way. So that's why I think it's still valuable for us to talk about this movie, because many people don't know how to answer those questions themselves.
It's definitely interesting. I don't disagree with that at all. But then also specifically with Love Exposure, that is about like, you know, he is doing a little bit of sex crimes throughout the movie, and it is in a fun, campy tone. And it does recontextualize that in a way that I don't know if I would find the movie as enjoyable on a rewatch. That was my tip.
And it often for me, it's exactly what you say, Slim, but it also makes me appreciate the performances of many of the, especially actresses in these films, to go, okay, that was happening and you did this. I mean, you know, we don't get to watch a lot of people actually do their jobs, you know, digger drivers. We're watching the digger, not the driver. You know what I mean? We are watching these people do their jobs, and then we learn under what working conditions they were doing them. And there's definitely an extra layer of respect and concern, I think, that comes up.
Yeah.
Right.
Just more cool people making movies like Ariella and Friends, I reckon.
Yes. When's the, I mean, the sci-fi movie's got to be next, right? You were talking about sci-fi being your favorite genre. I mean,
there's a sci-fi movie in the works, but it's ambitious. This is a long haul goal of mine. When someone will give me enough money.
Slim has a watch collection you could borrow for your costume department.
Thank you, Smart. Oh, we got one.
That's my in. I'll just.
Is a long term goal, but oh boy, is it a goal.
Hell yeah.
Yeah.
We'll be ready.
I already have the plot all mapped out. It's already being written.
Okay.
It's just that, like, it's not the project I'm pursuing immediately next.
When that happens, you'll come back on. We'll go long on Strange Days. And three other movies, because
that's part of what I watched.
Yeah. Yes. And how Slim got a producing credit for lending his watch collection to your sci-fi.
Our guest today was Ariella Barrere, and you can find them on Letterboxd using the link in our episode notes. Thanks to our crew, Jack for the facts, Brian Formo and Sophie Shin for booking and looking after our guests, Sam for the art, and to Monica for the theme music.
And to you, Slim, for editing out my little flubs and snubs and silly jokes.
There was no flubs in this episode. It was all 100% accurate. I don't even know if I edited this episode.
It is good to be back. And if you miss us between episodes, you can tune into Weekend Watchlist featuring Slim himself, Mitchell, and Mia. They explore the latest releases in theatres and on streaming, and they shuffle their watchlists for randomised movie fun. Please consider leaving us a review on Apple Podcasts, as it does help keep this show going. You can always drop us a line at podcast@letterboxd.com. We love mail. More guests coming soon. The Letterboxd Show is a Tape Deck production.
No quote, no line, nothing?
No. I got
a brand
today.
New season. Look at that. Oh my gosh.
This is a Tape Deck podcast.